Our reading today comes from Albert Einstein. The most beautiful and profound emotion we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. It is the sower of all true science. The one for whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. To know that what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which all our dull faculties can comprehend only in their primitive forms, this knowledge, this feeling, is at the center of true religion.
Part of my training for the ministry included a year of chaplaincy down at Mercy Medical Center in Oshkosh. That was very beautiful and meaningful work for me. I learned so much while I was there. The unit I served in, more than any other, was called the subacute floor. Patients there were mainly in transition. They may have progressed along their healing process to the point where they didn't need such intense nursing care anymore, but they weren't quite ready to go home. Maybe they needed more time with rehab. The other group of patients that were on that floor were patients that were dying, that they also no longer needed acute nursing care. And it was a very interesting place to provide spiritual support for folks and their families, because everyone on that floor knew that one way or another, they were on their way out in a matter of days. Now, I remember particularly a woman named Helene. Her diagnosis was emphatically terminal, and her death, we all knew, was not long away. She was quite coherent and pleasant, completely unafraid, very engaged and thankful for every bit of comfort that I and the other staff members could offer her. Helene had only one daughter, no other relatives, and that daughter was devoted. She came every single day, but she lived a distance away. And when Helene's death did come, it was in the middle of the night. There was a snowstorm. I was paged in time to come and sit with her through her final breaths. And once the nursing staff had completed all of their immediately necessary tasks, they left the room and I waited there with Helene. I knew that her daughter was on her way, had been delayed because of the storm. And I didn't want her daughter to walk into that room unaccompanied. So I sat next to this woman with whom I had gently conversed so many times, and most recently, just a few hours before. And I held the space as those minutes ticked by. And I watched her body gradually and quite visibly make the transition from life to death. Now, of course, she was clinically dead already. But it was a marvel to see how her life force, if you will, trickled away as every bit of Helene's appearance gradually changed. Every inch of her, her skin, her hair, all of it lost the sensation and the evidence of life. This felt quite like a sacred and holy time for me, not unlike the joy that I have felt at being present at baby's births. This visible animation of life coming in or going out, both are wondrous things. Helene's daughter did eventually arrive, and I was grateful to be there to support her. And I have long remembered that time that I spent with Helene prior to her arrival, and others like Helene, but this one particularly is in my memory. And I wonder, what, if anything, such an experience as that has to tell us about the existence of our souls. Now, that's today's topic, the next in our big question series. Through the month of February, we will be exploring questions around the soul and the afterlife. My focus today is mainly on the former. In subsequent weeks, we'll be dealing with the afterlife. I hope you'll come back for those. But this thing that we're attempting to discuss today, the soul, is something about which there is no generally accepted idea of what it really is, where it's located, how one might quantify it. And even though that's true, It doesn't seem to impede our use of that word, making frequent references to it in our language. The soul comes up all the time in our common speech. We talk about a piece of music or art as having soul. We refer to true and great lovers we know as being soulmates. We long to find a vocation that feeds our soul. When we speak of seeking our greatest personal truth, we talk about soul searching. Now, those are just a few examples. In our call together, Karen shared a quote from Ray Charles, and he points out that a soul has the power to light up a room like electricity, even though we don't fully comprehend how that happens. Now, some people use soul interchangeably with spirit, and so it often carries that sense of the undefined, non-physical, eternity-oriented part of us. For many, the word soul has a distinctly religious connotation. And for ages, theologians have declared what they believe to be God's truth as they've offered their own pronouncements about the soul's existence and its purpose and its ultimate disposition. I, for one, and I know many of you well enough to know that at least some of you this is also true, got my earliest religious training through rote memorization of the Baltimore Catechism. It was an amazing book. Everything one wanted to know about our spiritual lives was spelled out there in brief, very particular answers. It was long before all of those Four Dummies publications became so popular, but it might have fit well into that model. It was a complete guide to faithful living in the Roman Catholic Church of the day. And in the version that I studied, which was way back in the 50s, the first set of questions there went directly to the point of how we humans got to this earth, who it was that made us, and of what substance we were made. And I and my tiny parochial school chums learned those recitations very quickly. And then the third question went right to the point of what we're discussing today. Question number three, what is man? And yes, it did say, what is man? Answer, man is a creature composed of body and soul, made in the image and likeness of God. So at a very young age, I accepted this as gospel truth, so to speak. And in those days, I didn't notice that gender-limiting pronoun. I believed unquestioningly that I was made of a body and a soul, distinct parts that came together to make up little Dorothy Matthews. Further down in the Catechism's Q&A listing, and supported by abundant editorial comments from our teachers, it was made very clear that if there ever was a choice between responding to the beckonings of the soul and the beckonings of the body, and it was presented that frequently humans are presented with this choice, that God would be well pleased if I responded to the beckonings of the soul instead of the body, because it was the soul that would go on into eternity, that the body was just a corporeal casing, and that if it was only had a purpose to accommodate my life on this earth so that I could eventually earn my infinite heavenly reward in the form of my soul. Tangentially, but inextricably attached to these notions of the soul is the concept of free will, because in this schema, it is our free will that allows us to choose to nurture the soul rather than respond to the body's calls. I'm just sharing one of my earliest learnings about the soul. I know that each of you has your own stories, and I also know that in this intervening half century, a lot of those religious truths and teachings have changed, that they've moved beyond some of those simplistic answers. As I journeyed into my adult spiritual life, of course, my beliefs changed a great deal. I didn't so much reject that dogma of the soul, but I grew away from it having any importance for me. The significance just kind of faded away, and I probably set it aside at the same time that I lost my fear of hell, and I banished the idea of an anthropomorphic God sitting on a throne making decisions about the world. As I learned about world religions and became more cross-culturally educated, I was able to pretty quickly reject the limited concepts that seemed to make the divine forces of the universe so petty, so human. I, like many of you, began to look at those as teaching and doctrines that were the reflection of a man who had created a God in his image rather than the other way around. So I let go of that strict dualist idea that my soul would one day be judged for all that my body did or did not do in this lifetime. And I became, and I remain, far more concerned with the peace and the compassion and the happiness that I and others in this life might experience, rather than some ephemeral part of me that one day might attain peace in the sweet by and by. But that does not mean that I necessarily gave up entirely on the idea that there is within us some ineffable peace of the grand and infinite mystery. I don't pretend to know about these things, but I have my own inklings and leanings. I have more questions than answers, but we'll come back to all that in just a minute. First, let's talk about what some other people think about this. In your order of service insert, I have offered you three books on this subject, three of the many that are available, having to do with the science of the soul or the mind, that unquantifiable essence of us. Now, those three are not religious books. The subject of the soul has moved beyond the realm of theology, and for the last many years, it has been studied by philosophers and psychologists and scientists. And still, similar to those theologians of ages past, they too are unable to come up with any sort of unanimity about what the soul is. That first book that is listed there is by Francis Crick, and I discovered that one in the mid-1990s. The title tells you quite a bit about it, The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. Crick, as you may know, is one of the primary scientists who is credited with identifying the double helix structure of our DNA. Now, that discovery, of course, catapulted our learnings about life onto whole new levels. After his highly acclaimed work there, he continued his explorations, delving further and further and further into what it means to be human. And toward the end of his life, he published this, which he called his Astonishing Hypothesis. And he summed it up in his book by saying this: his hypothesis is that the you, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are, in fact, no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. So in his book, Crick offers a great deal of evidence to support his belief that the I that I think of as me and the you that you think of as you is simply the way that our brain's neurons happen to be firing on any given day when we're thinking about us. At the time I read this, about 15 years ago, that was an entirely new concept for me. Even though I had long ago set aside the idea of a separate soul that was a part of me, but not really a part of me, even though I wasn't attached to that idea at all, I did somehow think that there was something special in my own consciousness, something that goes beyond the mere mix of happenstance of brain chemistry, something I didn't understand, but I sensed that it was grand and mysterious. Now, you may have heard me say in prior sermons that I have no firm opinion on the idea of reincarnation. One way or another, I don't know. But I know that it feels like I have had numerous lifetimes in this life. I have been that tiny, obedient Catholic schoolgirl. I have been a troubled teenager. I have been a young stay-at-home mom. I have been a single parent, working mother, student, a business executive, a seminarian, a minister. And you, I know your lives hold similar successive narratives. And it's been strangely comforting to me, as I reflect on those dramatically different paths that I've walked along, that through each of those scenarios, it has been me. Different clothes, different body, different relationships, but always, reliably, me. Is that my soul? A Francis Crick would say no. No, it's just brain chemistry. He's careful, though, despite his boiling this down to a purely materialistic brain function, to say that it is still, in his estimation, an awesome brain function. And it is mysterious, inasmuch as it is not entirely understood yet. He believed until his own dying day that all of this will one day be fully understood, just as all the other mysteries, or so many other mysteries of the universe, have been unveiled through persistent research by brilliant minds. So we have his utter materialistic view, and then we have some counterproposals that are offered in that second book that's listed there, The Soul Hypothesis, Investigations into the Existence of the Soul. Now, this one is a compilation of essays offering what amounts to alternatives to Crick's view. Many of them are saying in response to his hypothesis, yes, yes, of course, science has shown in multiple ways that we are the sum and function of our chemistry. But it's also possible that we are more than that. The unanswered questions about how our mind and our soul and our free will work leave room for something ethereal, maybe even eternal, and beyond our knowing. For instance, one of the things that is described in that book that scientists don't understand is how free will works. They talk about experiments where scientists wire up subjects. And we know that for a long time, scientists have been able to attach electrodes in certain places, and through pushing a button, they can cause a subject to move an arm or move a leg. An interesting aspect of this, though, is that when the researcher causes a person to move, the subject is aware that this was not a volitional act. It did not involve free will, even though it was his or her body moving. He or she may say to the scientist, "I didn't do that. You made me do that." And so the I of the person was not engaged in that movement, even though no other person physically caused the body to move. Science knows how to make a body respond to stimuli to move in a directed manner, but they have not figured out how to make a person decide to move. They haven't yet discovered how to incite a person's free will to take a particular action. And so we return to that aspect of this conversation, free will. That is a part of us, as was once famously said, that is our decider. We feel as if there is an internal process going on in us, and we weigh factors, and we choose one response over another, and that is more than our chemical programming. But the question then is, well, who or what is actually doing the choosing? What within us makes those decisions? Who or what is the me within me? And how does all that fit with choice and accountability? I will be fully honest with you, as you know I am wont to do, and say that I know my own limitations very well. Honestly, I possess neither a scientist's education or mentality, nor do I have the patience to follow intricate philosophical arguments about things like this. I hold all of those authors and scientists in high regard, and I'm glad for what I've been able to glean from reading their books. And, by the way, I do want to especially point you to that third book that's listed there, Pictures of the Mind. The author, Miriam, attends the fellowship here. She's a friend of the fellowship, and she's put together a great book that really is very readable and talks about all the current science on this subject. And Miriam was here at the 4:30 service, and I wish that she might be here at all of them because she could be my technical consultant. But even though I don't understand fully the science behind all of this, what remains is a deeply fascinating question for me is, what is it that makes me me? And what does it matter? I was once at a minister's retreat, and we were exploring this question of identity. We were given an exercise that turned out to be surprisingly emotional for the participants. We were invited to pair up and hopefully to choose someone that we didn't already know. As we sat two by two, one of the partners was instructed to look at the other and ask, "Who are you?" And the other person responded with the first sentence about him or herself that came to mind. "I'm Dottie Matthews, associate minister at the Fox Valley UU Fellowship." To which the other person said, "Yes, and who are you?" And I responded again, naming myself as Rosie Geiser's life partner. Yes, and who are you? I am the mother of my three children, Philip, Ange, and Tim. Yes, and who are you? The daughter of Alec and Jane and the sister of my siblings? Yes, and who are you? On and on the questions went until each respondent had exhausted all of those available external reference points of identification. And still the questions persisted. Yes, and who are you? Nervous laughter emerged for some. Quiet insights opened up for a few. Tears fell for many. It was far more poignant and piercing than it may sound as I simply retell it to you today. The exercise was timed to last several minutes, each question peeling away yet another layer. As we looked into each other's eyes and we struggled to identify who, essentially and deeply, who it is that we are in this world. And we know, obviously, that the I, the me, the we that we're speaking of today goes far beyond our mere bodies. For example, if perchance I was in an auto accident and I lost an arm or was otherwise maimed, the loss of a body part would not make me not me. Similarly, you've heard about people who have experienced locked-in syndrome, where they've lost nearly 100% of their body's movement ability. And yet, still inside, their mind is still working in self-referential ways. They are still them, even though their body cannot move at all. Is that their soul? But then I pick up the other side of that argument and I say, well, sure, but what if that auto accident had caused a brain injury instead of a physical injury? What if my personality changed entirely, as we know does sometimes happen? Well, what about the soul then? Doesn't that disprove Crick's hypothesis? Good questions. Intriguing to think about. What do you think? For me, this is one of the central questions of the soul. Who are you? By whatever language we call it, it seems that the soul is that part that is most inherently, most indispensably ourselves. Whether it is eternal or not, I guess we don't really know, but most agree that our soul is the core of who we are in this world. And when you sweep away all the pretense, when you set aside all the expectations, when you strip away all the responsibilities and identities that we've accepted in this life, when you are once and for all standing in your truest and most real of places, that is where your soul resides. And that I perceive to be a place of beauty and peace. There is a grace-filled poem, a blessing, really, in the back of our hymnals. It's by Thich Nhat Hanh, and the first lines of it elegantly capture his wish for our souls. He wrote, "Let us be at peace in our bodies and our minds. Let us return to ourselves and become wholly ourselves." Now, if I am wholly myself, does it say anything about the possibilities for some spark of the infinite to be within us? Maybe not, but I told you that I would share my own inklings on this, and it just seems to me that there is something more outside of our limited knowledge and experience. It has nothing to do with eternal rewards or punishments for me, but this universe is so vast, and the depths of what we know are illimitable. As is so often the case, what we leave you with are your own ponderings and explorations. But for me, on this day, it seems that I agree that what we call our soul is really just a miraculous mess of brain chemistry. And there is a mystery beyond that for me that is currently out of reach. Something that, to my thinking, will not hold my consciousness, but will, when I die, return to the greater whole in a new form, energy converted to some other form of energy, something new. And, as always, I know I could be wrong. What I feel more certain about, though, is that we all have a core being that longs to express itself. There is a uniqueness within each one of us, some call of our soul to wholeness. And that, I do believe, requires our willingness and our openness in order to find its fullest expression. If we fail to uncover that essence of ourselves, it will not be experienced on this earth by any other means, whether it is through the mysteries that science will one day open up for us or the mysteries of the universe. Let us absorb and live that Thich Nhat Hanh blessing. Let us be at peace in our bodies and in our minds. Let us return to ourselves and become wholly ourselves. May it be so. Amen.